My laboratory's been interested in applying pulse laser methods to look at fast processes in protein folding. And what I'd like to do today is talk about a few of the problems that we've been working on that might be of interest to physicists. I don't know whether I'll succeed in that, but that's the goal. Now, I understand that you've had some introductory lectures from Henri, and Ken Dill's already told you about the protein folding problem, but people usually don't mind being reminded of simple things. Okay, so there, by way of introduction, it's generally considered there's two parts to the protein folding problem. One is giving the amino acid sequence, what is the three-dimensional structure? So here's a 56 amino acid protein. It's called the immunoglobulin binding domain of streptococcal protein G. And I like to use this as an example because it has a very simple topology, and it's one of those proteins that even people who aren't experts in structure like myself can go to the board and generally get it right. And what it is a it's basically an anti-parallel pleated sheet with a helix line on top of it. So I assume now you've heard something about helices and sheets. So these are just strands of the polypeptide that are connected by hydrogen bonds. And this is the famous alpha helix, predicted by Linus Pauling in 1951 to be a major component of protein structure. It's kind of amusing. Pauling, who is this legendary theoretical chemist, along with Corey, built models of polypeptides and decided that two stable structures would be the anti-parallel and parallel sheet, and the alpha helix would be another one. Polymer physicists knew about sheets, so that wasn't considered a rather remarkable prediction. The remarkable one was the alpha helix. That was a totally unknown structure. The database now of proteins is about 12,000, 13,000. And I was told recently that someone in surveying secondary structures, looking through the database, discovered that proteins are about one-third alpha helix, one-third beta sheet, and one-third sort of nondescript structure. So it was rather remarkable. Discovery that Pauling made based on simple chemical and physical principles and his knowledge of X-ray structures and valence bond theory. Okay, so this is the holy grail of structural biology because of the explosion of sequences. Tens of thousands of sequences are being discovered every year, and experimental science just can't keep up with it. So one would like to be able to compute the three-dimensional structure just from the sequence that are being discovered by the genomists. So that's the first part of the protein folding problem. And I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about the second part that Ken Dill talked about yesterday. Given the amino acid sequence, how does a protein fold? Now, the answer to this question depends very much on the discipline that one comes from, clearly. The question was answered by biologists for the most part, although Sophie Jackson's going to give some counterexamples, by Chris Enfinson at the NIH 40 years ago when he discovered that you could denature an enzyme and refold it in the laboratory spontaneously to form a functioning biological structure. And from this he concluded that all of the information necessary to fold a protein up into its unique native structure was contained in the amino acid sequence. Well, he had answered the question for the biologists. That's all the biologists wanted to know, that it's a spontaneous process, and therefore I can go on to the next problem. If there were enzymes involved, that would have made it a biologically interesting problem. Now, this problem has resurfaced with the discovery that there are many proteins. In bacteria, it's estimated to be, say, something of the order of 5 to 10%. Typical bacterium will have about 10,000 proteins, 5 to 10,000 proteins. So there are many hundreds of proteins in bacteria that don't fold spontaneously. They need help from other proteins. And the most famous one is GroEL, which forms this huge cage to which the unfolded protein or partially folded protein or misfolded protein will bind to a hydrophobic surface, and then ATP is used. This machine will undergo a structural change, sort of tear the protein apart, spit it back into the solution, and let it try to fold again. So basically, the most commonly held view is that these chaperones prevent unfolded proteins from aggregating. Now, a chemist or biological chemist wants to know a little bit more. And of course, biochemistry these days is totally dominated by structural biology. And there's actually a consensus in the biochemical community that the problem is solved for them as well. Namely, that proteins form by accruing more and more native structure in a sequence of steps. And the only issue is which bits form first. Now, this kind of understanding of protein folding, of course, can make no quantitative predictions. And it's not satisfactory to a physical scientist. And furthermore, it may not be true in general. What a physical scientist would like to know, I think, is if we start from this vast ensemble of unfolded polypeptides, what's the number of routes that structures can take to get to the final unique structure of the native state, and what's the distribution of these routes? This is something that it's going to be a very difficult problem to describe experimentally, and it's one of the reasons, and I'll come back to this at the very end of my talk, that there's a lot of enthusiasm about developing single molecule techniques to study protein folding, because you can see at this level it really is an issue of looking at individual molecules to obtain distributions that average properties that you measure in ensemble experiments is not going to answer the question. Even the simplest kind of kinetic mechanism with three or four states is very complicated to actually prove which mechanism is the correct one. And so there is some optimism that single molecule experiments might lead to the answer. The idea that one should look at protein folding from a statistical view goes back almost 20 years now. The original analytical work of the type that people think about today was done in three places, Bringelson and Wolinus at Illinois, Orlan and Garel in Saclay, and Shaknevich and Guten tried to bring some of the power of modern polymer physics to bear on the problem. In terms of computational / theoretical work, Ken Dill introduced, and you heard about it yesterday, the use of toy models, even two-dimensional lattice models, have been useful in basically clarifying issues. Not that they'll tell us how a protein folds, but I think they've been extremely important in being able to ask sort of sharp questions about the issues. Jose Onuchik will be speaking this week also, Eugene Shaktovich, Ken, Dave Turumalai, and others have exploited three-dimensional lattice models, somewhat more realistic representations. Dave Turumalai also pioneered the application of off-lattice models. Now what people are doing theoretically, is actually they're performing all-atom simulations, something that was thought to be hopeless, not only just a few years ago, but in fact computational power is growing, and there are clever methods of using computers that have actually made people think that it would be possible to fold a very fast folding protein. Very fast folding proteins now are proteins that fold in microseconds. 10 years ago, people thought that proteins would take seconds or hundreds of milliseconds and then tens of milliseconds, but now, as you'll see, the time scale's been pushed to shorter and shorter times. Now, and okay, so I'm going to talk about experimental approaches to protein folding, and there have basically been two generic approaches experimentally. The most fruitful so far have come from developments in Cambridge, England, where Sophie Jackson and Alan Furst recognized more than 10 years ago that if one's going to understand protein folding, it's best to get rid of all of the complicating factors, namely to look at a protein that has no prosthetic groups. That's like an organic molecule, like a porphyrin or a flavin, some non-amino acid structure that is added to the protein to perform some specific chemistry. To get rid of disulfide bonds, the amino acid cysteine has sulfur as a side chain, and these two sulfurs can come together to form a covalent bond and link pieces of the protein together. This introduces complications in the folding reaction. Proline is an amino acid that slowly isomerizes. Lots of proteins have metals that are stabilize structure, sometimes the metal is the catalytic site. So what Jackson and Furst did was they went to a small protein that doesn't have any of these complications, chymotrypsin inhibitor 2, which in its 64 amino acid version behaves like a perfect two-state system. Now, by two-state system, what I mean is that at equilibrium, there are only two populations that exist. The unique structure of the native state and the denatured ensemble. And if one changes the population by changing the temperature, changing the pH, the salt, chemical denaturants, whatever, all one will ever see is the appearance of one population at the expense of the disappearance of the second one. Aha, yet another transparency, wonderful. Thank you. With the factor of two. So you wouldn't complain. Now, with the two-state system, one can characterize an intermediate state, which chemists call the transition state. This is the top of a, if one could say describe the folding process in terms of a single order parameter, and I'll show you a profile like this later, then one describes the dynamics on this complex free energy surface as the dynamics on a one-dimensional free energy profile, and the distribution of species that are at the top of the free energy, the top of the free energy barrier, is known by chemists as the transition state, going back to Irene's theory from the 1930s. And the way Fürst and his colleagues characterized this transition state was to use protein engineering. And the idea of the protein engineering experiment is to carry out what's called site-directed mutagenesis, where you can use recombinant DNA technology to replace one amino acid with another amino acid. So it's kind of a perturbation approach in which one can determine whether the interactions that a specific residue makes are present in the transition state. And it's based on linear free energy ideas, and Sophie's going to talk about this a lot, so I'm not going to spend too much time, but just to give you a flavor, and the simple idea is, for example, if we make a green mutation and destabilize the protein so that whereas there was an equal population of native and denatured state, we destabilize the native state. If the transition state is destabilized by exactly the same amount, it means that it has the same thermodynamic properties and therefore the same interactions. The inference is that it has the same interactions and structure in the transition state. And the relative rates divided by the relative change in the equilibrium constant, the logarithms thereof, is called the phi value. So if a phi is 1, then this residue makes its interactions in the transition state. If it's 0, it doesn't make any of them. Okay, so because there's an enormous amount of detailed structural information in this experiment, it really has been the experiment that most theorists are trying to explain. And you'll hear from Alexei Finkelstein a statistical mechanical theory approach to explaining these phi values. Now, the second approach, which actually is the older one, it actually goes back to Pauling, I call the sort of Aufbau approach. The idea is that if we're going to understand how a protein folds in detail, then it's essential to understand how the individual structural elements form, how helices form, how beta structure forms, how loop forms. So here's this protein GB1 again. And loosely speaking, proteins are made of helices, sheets, and loops. This is really a tight turn, but you'll give me some artistic license. And even though helices were studied back into the 50s, it wasn't until the late 1980s that Buzz Baldwin and Susan Marcoussi were able to show that synthetic peptides that are protein-like peptides, that is, they have compositions similar to what are found in proteins, are stable in isolation in water. Previously, what people had found is they would cut up a helical protein, and with a few exceptions, they would just find random coil-type structures. But alanine, which is an amino acid which just has a methyl group as a side chain, has a high propensity to form a helix, and these are so-called alanine-based peptides. So it was possible then to study the equilibrium properties of these by circular dichroism techniques. And then in the, as we'll see in a minute, we were able to study the dynamics of this system, the kinetics and the dynamics, using laser temperature jump. And this was first done actually on a helix by Dyer and Woodruff at Los Alamos. The hairpin, this little thing that looks like a hairpin is the sort of basic element of the anti-parallel pleated sheet. So this protein has two hairpins, one at the N-terminal end and one at the amino terminal end and one at the carboxy terminal end. And the problem with hairpins is that in isolation, they're very sticky. And it wasn't until the middle 1990s that a couple of groups were able to show by nuclear magnetic resonance that it was possible to cut out hairpins from protein structures and show that they're actually stable in isolation. The problem is, for nuclear magnetic resonance, one needs very high concentrations, and at high concentrations, hairpin structures tend to stick together. Another interesting structure is just a simple loop, or if you like, more generically, the formation of, say, a contact between a residue in one part of the sequence with a residue that's far apart in the sequence. The reason this is important is that the protein, of course, is made up of these secondary structural elements, but it's these long-range contacts that are crucial for maintaining the overall topology. So we were interested in developing, and have been interested in trying to develop a specific experimental technique that could look at the dynamics of tertiary contacts. We've come up with one, and I'm going to tell you about that today. Now, another sort of fundamental process that is of particular interest to polymer physicists is collapse. If we imagine a polypeptide at high temperature or at room temperature in a high concentration of a denaturant, which is a molecule that sort of binds to the interior residues of a protein and makes it unfold, there's a fundamental issue of, when a polypeptide collapses, are there any generalities about this collapse process? Is there a barrier to collapse? When a polypeptide collapses to form a condensed structure, does the structure have a topology that's native-like, or does the structure behave more like a random globule? These are still fundamentally unanswered questions. I guess I should take a step back and add another comment to the introduction to this presentation, which is what one's looking for, of course, are some kind of generalities about this complicated process. And one might be, do proteins that have similar topologies fold by the same mechanism? So if we look at a protein that has a certain kind of topology, are the sequence of structural events similar in a given class of proteins? And it's the kind of problem where all of you physicists in the audience, in looking at this diagram, will have different questions. I mean, the way I drew this was, here's three roots. In one root, the carboxy terminal hairpin forms first, and then the rest of the structure in these multiple steps here adds on. Here's the N-terminal hairpin forming first. Here's a helix forming first, maybe the whole polypeptide collapses into some condensed structure with no secondary structure, and then the secondary structure forms in the condensed state. Maybe the two hairpins come together to form the sheet, and then the helix adds to the sheet. These are the kinds of things that you would like to know and be able to describe and be able to generate some model which can predict these things quantitatively. Okay, so that's the end of the introduction. I was told I should speak longer than an hour. You said no. Now you say no. I can speak if I have nothing to say. Is that what you said? Okay, but please interrupt me. I mean, everything I've said so far, I'm sure is you've heard before, but everybody agrees with it. Oh, I see. Okay, so sure.
Is there any sense that proteins have evolved over time? Does it make sense to ask?
Oh, yeah. No, that's actually one of the most interesting questions.
Oh, okay.
And let me come to that at the end. And that's, I mean, that's a real interesting issue at two different levels, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. One level, mm-hmm. And this is work that originated with Bringelson and Wallenus, is that proteins, in fact, do evolve to form to develop what Jose will describe to you as a funneled energy surface. That if you were a polymer physicist thinking about heteropolymers, you would say, well, you know, this thing is there. You'll never get this structure. There'll be so many deep traps that that it would be impossible to form such a complicated structure. So one of the really interesting ideas, and nobody has been able to actually show a way, demonstrate this in the database by looking at sequences, but a wonderful idea is that it's called the principle of minimal frustration, in which the non-native interactions, that is the interactions between residues that do not take place in the final native structure, that the sequences evolve to minimize these non-native interactions, or put it another way, sequences have evolved to minimize the depth of traps, if you like, in a complex energy landscape. Then there's another idea that if you believe that proteins fold by a nucleation mechanism, and if we get the chance to talk about this, nucleation in this sense is somewhat different than you would think of as a physicist when you think of, say, nucleation of water droplets from supersaturated air, that there are specific clusters of residues that are preserved in evolution that are preserved to make sure that proteins fold in a biologically usable time scale. Takes about a minute for a bacterium to synthesize, say, a 300 amino acid protein. So it wouldn't make too much sense if the protein would take an hour to fold when the bacterium is replicating faster than that. So, but these are really interesting fundamental issues.
It's just one part of it.
So the reason, I'll tell you why in general, why it's a really important issue. If you were not in the protein folding field and you're just a scientist from any area and you ask, you know, what have you guys learned about protein folding? Nobody wants to hear about these detailed dynamical issues that I'm going to talk about today. What they'd like to know is there some new general scientific idea? And the one that is the sexy scientific idea is that folding speed is a previously unrecognized pressure in the evolution of proteins, that when people look and compare protein sequences, that they only think about evolution in terms of structural stability and function, but not in terms of dynamics.
But what's the advantage of microsecond versus millisecond? I mean, for that kind of improvement, is there any significance? I mean,
I'm going to come back to this, right? And we've actually done some calculations that will back of the envelope type stuff to answer that. But okay, so What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about tertiary contact formation. Then I'm going to say something about the helix coil transition. I'm going to just mention beta hairpin formation. I probably won't be able to talk about polypeptide collapse. I want to say something about ultrafast protein folding, which is something that came from our ideas on these formation of structural elements. And then the holy grail of experimental science in this field is to do a single molecule protein folding experiment and watch molecules evolve, individual molecules evolve from an unfolded molecule to a native molecule. And all I'll do here, I have it in red, I'll just show you an apparatus that a brilliant young physicist in my lab just built. So I talk about tertiary contact formation first because it is, I guess, the simplest fundamental process you can think of, because it's contact between polypeptide strands or amino acid side chains occurs in helix formation, occurs in loop formation, it occurs in beta hairpin formation. Segments of the chain have to come together, and the question is, how do you measure the formation of a contact? Now, I got into this protein folding business by doing this in a protein called cytochrome C and using photochemical properties. But we wanted a generic method that took advantage of properties of the 20 amino acids, and the method we developed, or are in the midst of developing, takes advantage of two unique properties, one of cysteine, this is an amino acid with a sulfur side chain, and tryptophan, this is an amino acid that has an indole ring, a two-membered ring. I had a picture from some amino acids that an astrophysicist made for me at a lecture recently, but it's not that crucial. But you did show pictures of amino acids, right? Yeah, of course. Can you draw indole on the board? Yeah, that's right.
Please be careful.
Yeah, don't ask me to do it. Okay, I might. Okay, so the property is that if you excite tryptophan to its first excited electronic state, or second, it'll rapidly decay to the low vibrational levels of this singlet state, and there's a high probability, and it's not known exactly, but of the order of 1 in 10, the spins will flip, and one will end up in a triplet state. This is so-called intersystem crossing. This triplet state has a very long lifetime because its transition back to the ground state is spin forbidden. So it will live for at least 50 microseconds. Cysteine has this very special property that it quenches this triplet state. So if we can measure, which we can, the population of this triplet state is a function of time, we can measure the rate at which this cysteine comes up and makes contact with the tryptophan. And in this simple two-step kinetic model, it's a very general and useful way for thinking about almost any kind of chemical reaction. Namely, where two things have to come together. So there's a diffusive process where the chain is moving around in the solution, and this is now an end-to-end contact of a peptide chain. The cysteine then diffuses relative to the tryptophan. They come in contact with a rate constant, which I call Kd plus, to form what chemists call an encounter complex or a geminate pair. Now this rate Q is the quenching rate, and we don't know the details of this process. It could be an electron transfer process, it could be triplet energy transfer, some kind of electron exchange process that takes the tryptophan back to the ground state. But it does so with a very high efficiency. And our problem is to basically, if we could determine this probability that upon contact, the tryptophan will return to the ground state, then we can get the rate constant of interest, namely the rate at which these two guys come together. That's the rate of the tertiary contact. Okay. Now, what one observes is an overall rate of quenching, and that's equal to this rate times the probability that once this encounter complex is formed, which is given by this quenching rate divided by the quenching rate and the diffusive separation rate. So I'm going to show you data. The first set of data I'll show you is on this 11 residue peptide with cysteine at one end and tryptophan at the other. This is alanine, glycine, glutamine. And this sequence, it's this repeated triplet. This sequence was chosen because it's very unlikely that this sequence would form any kind of specific structure. So it's a truly disordered peptide. Pardon me?
Do you have other tricks to monitor the content of other monomers?
This is the only one we have so far of the amino acids. I should say, yeah, okay, so that's, I'm glad you asked that question, because the unique property of cysteine is that it's a thousandfold, three orders of magnitude more effective in quenching tryptophan than any of the other 19 amino acids. The closest one is tyrosine, which quenches a thousandfold more slowly. So you can, if one can insert a cysteine into a sequence in an arbitrary position, you can determine whether the cysteine is coming in contact with the tryptophan. So one uses then site-directed mutagenesis to put the cysteine in different positions, put the tryptophan in different positions, and measure the rate at which they come together. Okay, so this is just an energy level diagram to show what we're looking at. So we excite the tryptophan to its lowest singlet with a 290 nanometer laser pulse, about 5 nanoseconds in width. And as I said, there's about a 10% chance on each excitation that inter-system crossing will occur to the lowest triplet state. And this triplet state in water will decay in the order of 40 to 50 microseconds. And the way we monitor the population of this triplet state is simple optical absorption. It has an absorption peak right near this laser line of an argon ion laser. So it's a really simple experiment. Really bringing these techniques from physical chemistry to the protein folding problem has been, I guess, the major contribution of the physical chemist. Biochemists are more apt to and more interested in the materials and spend most of their time making elegant materials, and then will in general use whatever sort of commercially available instruments are around. So the physical chemists are willing to go and build new instruments. Even this one, of course, is a really simple one, where we just excite with a 200 LICAF laser pumped with a Q-switch neodymium YAG laser, and then probe with an argon ion laser. And what we see is just absorption as a function of time. So this is the optical density. It is just the logarithm of the incident intensity over the transmitted intensity in milliod. So we're looking at small signals. Here's a peptide with a tryptophan at one end, and instead of the cysteine, we have a glutamine, and you can see it's decaying in 40 microseconds. This is an exponential. There is some background. There's some photochemical problems with this system that really don't interfere with our determination of time constants, but there's some free radical formation that complicates the measurement a little bit. Now, we look at the peptide with the cysteine, and we see that there's almost three orders of magnitude decrease in this decay. Now, what we have to determine is what fraction of this time is the time to diffuse for the cysteine to diffuse up to the tryptophan, and what fraction of this time is some sort of barrier crossing process. And the way we resolve that issue is to go to a molecule, it's actually called lipoate, it's a cyclic disulfide, which we put at the end of this peptide, which is known from simple bimolecular quenching to be a perfect Smoluchowski molecule. That is, the rate of quenching is exactly the diffusion limited rate given by Smoluchowski. So we've established then that this probability is about a half, and that allows us then to go ahead and do some sort of polypeptide physics on the problem and look to see how the end-to-end contact rate depends on the number of peptide units. So here we're looking at the length dependence. This is the rate. This is 100 nanoseconds, 10 nanoseconds. This is the number of peptide bonds separating the cysteine from the tryptophan. And this line here is what you'd predict for random walk chain using the first passage time theory of Szabo, Shulton, and Shulton. Attila Szabo is a theorist in my lab and is constantly feeding me nice little equations out of his publications. And this rate of contact depends on the relative diffusion constant of the two ends coming together, the contact radius, that is how close they have to be before quenching occurs, and is inversely proportional to the 3/2 power of the mean squared end-to-end distance. Okay. Now, if one plugs in the van der Waal radii to give 4 angstroms for A, and we take our peptide where we've actually determined in a rather unique way, and I won't tell you about that, but if someone wants to discuss it after my talk, I'll tell you how we have actually a kinetic method based on a so-called Jacobs and Stockmeyer factor, which may mean something to some of you, where we can actually get the mean squared end-to-end distance, assuming it's a Gaussian chain. Okay? We plug these numbers in, and what we find is that the relative diffusion constant is 4 times 10 to the minus 7 centimeters squared per second. Now, this number has been bothering us for 8 years now. Alicia Haas, in a famous experiment with Itzhak Steinberg 20 years ago, used a Forrester resonance excitation energy transfer experiment to determine the relative diffusion constant of two ends of a peptide where he's looking at Forrester excitation energy transfer. This is singlet transfer, and has come up with a diffusion constant of about 5 times 10 to the minus 7. When we did our experiments on cytochrome C, this diffusion constant came out to be 5 times 10 to the minus 7. But the relative diffusion constant for a monomer, for these two monomers, is 40-fold faster. It's 10 to the minus 5. So what is the origin of this slow diffusion constant? Is it this first passage time theory, which is just motion on a purely entropic potential? Is this just all wet? Is it the assumption of a Gaussian chain? What's the problem? Why do we get this slow diffusion constant? I now want to move to these other structures. Say something briefly about the alpha helix and what some of the issues are there, something about the beta hairpin, and then ultra-fast folding protein. So this is the temperature jump apparatus that we use, and the idea here is that the fundamental of a YAG laser can be shifted to longer wavelength. 1540 nanometers is right in the middle of a water overturn vibration, so you can heat the sample with this laser pulse. And any process that has an enthalpy difference will then, there'll be a population change which we follow by fluorescence, excited with a frequency doubled argon ion laser, which takes an argon ion frequency down into the ultraviolet where it can excite the fluorescence of tryptophan. And this just shows that on a logarithmic scale that the temperature is maintained for almost six decades in time. So we have lots of dynamic range to play with. This is the molecule that we've looked at quite a bit. So this is a 21 residue peptide where in the eye, so this is a chemical representation, this is a structural biologist representation, and this is a chemist representation. And I should say my representation, which is a schematic, which I think shows what's going on, that the histidine, which is this five-membered ring that has a positive charge on it, is in the so-called I plus four position along the helix, so it can interact with the tryptophan. And here, it's been pretty well established that the quenching mechanism now of the fluorescence, not the phosphorescence, not the triplet state, but the singlet state, comes from an electron transfer process. So when the chain has this helical configuration, the fluorescence is quenched. And so the experiment is to excite the, to heat the solution with the laser pulse, and then monitor the fluorescence of the tryptophan in this peptide. So here's the time now. This is 0 to 1500 nanoseconds. The first thing we see is this very rapid drop in the quantum yield. The fluorescence decreases. And this has to do with the effect of temperature on the photophysics in the experiment. And then we see this slow population change. So what's happening now is the as we raise the temperature with the laser pulse, the helix is sort of unfolding. There's a net population shift to the unfolded form. And water does not quench tryptophan fluorescence as much as this protonated histidine, so there's an increase in the fluorescence. And this is carried out at three different temperatures. And we've what we'd like to extract from this experiment is the activation energy. As one of the principal parameters. Now, the problem with getting an activation energy is that there's a pre-exponential factor that has a temperature dependence because the viscosity of water is temperature dependent, and we have to correct the temperature dependence of the rate for the temperature dependence of the viscosity, and that's seen by looking at Cramer's theory for dynamics in the condensed phase. And what Cramer's did 60 years ago, he just solved the problem of escape from an energy well in a one-dimensional system. And what he showed was that in the high friction limit, where gamma is very large, the collision frequency, this is by solving, you actually solve something different, but this is just solving the Langevin equation for diffusive for motion out of this well. In the when the friction is high, then you get this very simple dependence of the rate, where the rate then is inversely proportional to the friction and therefore inversely proportional to the viscosity. But what people observe empirically in many systems is that this exponent on the viscosity is less than 1. So it's not following Cramer's equation for the high friction limit. In the intermediate friction case, this would also give a fractional exponent, but only over a very small dynamic range. Another possibility is that internal friction is contributing, and this is sort of a simple modification of Cramer's equation, that there's energy dissipation due to collisions between the atoms of the peptide, and not just between the peptide and the solvent. So we wanted to know how to, what we're interested in is getting the true, this number, the true activation energy. And what we discovered to our surprise was that that the slope wasn't 1. And when we increase the viscosity by increasing the concentration of sugars that have absolutely no effect on the equilibrium constant, we found that there wasn't a first order viscosity dependence. We looked at other systems, we looked at our beta hairpin, and we get a perfect first power viscosity dependence. And this is, again, something that is a challenge, I guess, for the theoretical physicist to understand. We double-checked this result because you could argue, well, you didn't change the equilibrium constant, but your solvent is perturbing the barrier height. So what we did was we studied this process as a function of temperature, and we're able to collapse all of the data onto a single universal curve by calculating the reduced rate, that is the experimental folding rate that we extract from the data times the exponential of the activation energy with a plus. And you see that all the data collapses onto one curve, and the slope is the same as we got at a single temperature. So we're still puzzled by this result. The only thing we've come up with so far is to use an explanation that was used many years ago by Graham Fleming in studying barrier crossing processes in small organic molecules with picosecond lasers, that that for high barriers, what he found was that the exponents were much smaller than for low barriers. So he compared a barrier crossing in the excited state with the ground state and found that the exponent was much larger when the barrier is smaller. So what we did was we made up a little sort of nucleation type model for the alpha helix and for the beta hairpin, and when we model the data using this simple nucleation model, what we find is that the barrier for the individual steps, what I showed you was the rate for the overall process, that the barrier for the individual steps, there's a significant positive activation energy. This is after correcting for all of the for the viscosity dependence, where in the case of the beta hairpin, the barrier is effectively 0. So one might expect that this is a much more diffusive type process and might follow Cramer's theory, whereas the higher barrier, using Fleming's explanation, is that there's a possibly too large a separation in time scales between the barrier crossing event itself and the solvent relaxation. In Cramer's theory, there is no separation in time scales. The solvent is always relaxing fast relative to the motion. So,
I'm sorry. You said this is a barrier for individual step, but for helix, you mean one term of helix?
In this particular model, it's for one dihedral angle flip, okay? All right, so I should say that both this contact formation and helix formation are taking place on a tens to hundreds of nanosecond time scale. Okay, we saw 50 nanoseconds for this end-to-end contact formation. We're looking at a few hundred nanoseconds for the helix. And we think that these are really sort of important experimental benchmarks for people trying to do all atom molecular dynamics simulations. Namely, you have to reproduce these experimental results. Now, one complaint that I have about most simulations is that people don't spend any time thinking about the physics of the experiment. So for example, in the helix formation, what are you going to do? Just decide what the distance is and angle between the tryptophan and the histidine is? No, what one's going to have to do is work on the theory of this quenching, and the theory, if it is indeed, as we think it is, an electron transfer process, so that one can calculate the probability of electron transfer in the trajectory as the structure evolves. And that's something that people haven't been willing to do so far. In the case of our end-to-end contact with cysteine and tryptophan, that looks like it's going to be a simpler story because it's just close contact, although we don't know anything about the angular dependence yet. Okay, with that sort of, I'll just say that this structure has been very interesting because it has so many of the elements of folding a small protein. So this is the chemical structural biologist in my representation of this beta hairpin. And this hairpin is stabilized by a cluster of hydrophobic groups, a tyrosine, a phenylalanine, a tryptophan, and a valine. And when you look at this structure, you can see that many of the fundamental issues that come up in folding a small protein come up in thinking about this hairpin, namely the loss of conformational entropy in ordering this chain into this hairpin structure, the hydrogen bonds between the two strands of the peptide, and the stabilization by the hydrophobic interaction.
So why don't the hydrophobic core aggregate with another
element? Well, it's just a subtle interplay of that's taking place, and I don't know that anybody, although there are people who design these peptides. You see, this is aspartate, lysine, glutamate, and another glutamate. So you see that there's four negative charges and only one positive charge. So it's probably there's enough electrostatic repulsion to keep the guys apart, not so much to blow it apart itself, so it blows apart, and just enough so that there's not the aggregation of the hydrophobic core in this peptide. So this peptide has the interesting property, which has attracted a lot of people to simulate what's going on, that it behaves like a perfect two-state system. Peptides were generally thought to be going to turn out to be really complicated. They're not going to behave like a compact single-domain protein. And we showed this both by equilibrium studies and kinetic studies. Here's the peptide unfolding. Here we look at forced or excitation energy transfer, so that here the mechanism is being dominated by the fact that the excitation, what Forster's theory says is there's this dipole-dipole interaction between these transition moments, so there's a probability that if you excite the tryptophan here that the excitation will end up on this acceptor, which we added to the molecule. This is a so-called Denzel group. So now when the peptide opens up, as we raise the temperature in this temperature jump experiment, the distance between these two gets larger. So there's a net increase in the unfolded population, and the rate of transfer decreases, so the fluorescence quantum yield goes up. Here we just have contact quenching operating, but these time constants are identical to within the accuracy of the measurement, which is about 10%. So this is sort of the hallmark of a two-state system kinetically. As I said before, it wouldn't matter how sophisticated the probe, that if you have a two-state system, you'll see the same relaxation rate independent of how you probe the system. We've looked at another hairpin recently just to show that this time constant is not anomalous, and I just show this to point out that this hairpin, the relaxation rate in this hairpin, which is of similar size, is comparable time, 16 microseconds. So hairpins are, their rates are about an order of magnitude slower than helices. Pardon me?
For
Tibetan,
you told that there is ozone transition.
Right.
Two-state transition.
Right.
For Kinesis, it was also a two-state transition, or it was possible?
The helix is close. I mean, you can actually model it like it's a two-state transition. You can actually fit the data reasonably well. The big issue with the helix, and it hasn't been seen yet, is that there's an additional relaxation that's predicted that will clearly show that it's not just a simple two-state system, but it's too fast to resolve. It's the growth rate. So basically, the slow eigenvalue is the barrier crossing, and then there's a cluster of eigenvalues of much faster rates that are growth. So, you know, in a simplistic picture, there's the slow nucleation followed by rapid growth. And that rapid growth rate should be observed in the kinetics, but it has a time constant which is within our 10 nanosecond laser pulse. And we just have to build a picosecond system to actually look for that relaxation. And all the modeling predicts that it should be observable. So one of the interesting insights that came from looking at this hairpin, and I show this because this is related to work that Kevin Plaxico's done, who's in the audience, and the idea here is that a useful way of looking at kinetics is to take the sort of simplest possible statistical picture you can, namely, make up a partition function, make up a reaction coordinate, and hope that the dynamics of the system can be described by diffusion on a one-dimensional free energy profile, which I alluded to early. So the natural reaction coordinate for this system would be the number of native peptide bonds. This is a simple partition function that just includes the hydrogen bond interaction, the hydrophobic interaction, and the entropy loss in ordering the peptide chain. Then one just takes this partition function, divides it up into groups according to the number of peptide bonds, and we get what is referred to as a free energy functional, and just plot this out as a function of the number of native peptide bonds. And what you see is that you get a two-state system out of this very elementary statistical mechanical description. And an unfolded state, and a folded state that's not completely folded because the ends are frayed. The hydrogen bonds are not enough to defeat the loss in entropy, so that you don't get the fully formed hairpin as the most stable state. So the insight that we got from this modeling, and I should say that we spend most of our time modeling rather than making measurements, but I thought it's more important today to tell you more, you know, I think people are more interested in the measurements than our models. The insight that we got from this was that if you do an imaginary experiment in which we move the cluster, let me just go through this for 1 second. So what this model is predicting is that the system is climbing an entropy hill. It's ordering the chain. There's a couple of hydrogen bonds that are made in this model, but one doesn't get over the top of the free energy barrier until one forms this first hydrophobic interaction. And it's only after forming this first hydrophobic interaction that the system goes downhill, because now it can form additional hydrophobic interactions as well as the hydrogen bonds. Okay, so this is what the chemists call the transition state. Okay, between the sixth and seventh native peptide bond. Now, if you do an imaginary experiment in which you move the cluster that's stabilizing the structure closer to the turn, what you see is that that we reach the transition state earlier along this reaction coordinate. The fully formed hairpin has all the same interactions, the three blue hydrophobic van der Waals interactions, the same number of hydrogen bonds, we've fixed the same number of peptide bonds, but the relative population of the fully formed hairpin compared to the completely coil structure, the relative free energies of these are exactly the same, but this hairpin forms faster. So what it says is that if you realize the stabilizing interactions early along the reaction coordinate, that the rate is going to speed up. No, Murphy was in the laboratory. We tried making this, but there are structural problems because you can't just move the cluster one bond because they flip to the other side of the hairpin. They make different interactions. So this is, and it doesn't matter whether this mechanism is correct either, and it doesn't matter whether we can make this hairpin. It was sort of the idea that led us to an explanation of observations that Plaxico and Baker made, and allowed us to develop our own, to use this model actually for whole proteins, which I won't talk about at all today. Okay, but this was the, so what Plaxico and Baker were looking for was some systematic way of explaining the relative rates of folding of single domain two-state proteins. And they must have tried lots of things, right? Just about everything. First try, okay. And what, so the idea was, is there something about these structures that would explain why, for example, lambda repressor folds in 100 microseconds, but muscle acyl phosphatase takes almost 10 seconds? Is there something about these structures? And what they noticed was that the rates actually correlated reasonably well, particularly for the alpha-beta proteins. These are proteins that have alpha helices and beta sheets. Greens just have beta strands. Alphas are all alpha helical with no beta structure. They found quite a reasonable correlation between the rate and what they called the contact order. Now, what's the contact order? The contact order is the mean separation between contacting atoms in the structure. So if we take residue I in the sequence and residue J in the sequence and weight it by the number of atomic contacts, sum them up, divide by the total number of atomic contacts, one gets this percent contact order. They also put in a length normalization, but I don't think that makes very much of a difference. I mean, you'll get the same correlation, almost as good a correlation without this length normalization, which probably should be in the numerator, but that's a different issue. I don't think it's an important point. The important thing is it's this mean separation in sequence. So you can see that if you have a protein where there's a lot of short-range interactions, that means as this protein is folding, it's realizing these stabilizing interactions early. That is, one does not have to order a large amount of chain in order to realize the stabilizing interactions. And I should also mention that this is not a trivial result of a relation between rate and stabilization. So they showed that there's no correlation between the rate and the free energy of stabilization. And this led to the very important conclusion, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, is that native interactions are what's dominating the folding mechanism. That it may be possible to understand protein folding at knowing just the final three-dimensional structure, and in the case of our model, for predicting these rates, the thermodynamic stability. Now we're going to come to the last topic, and this sort of summarizes What I've told you about structural elements, helices form in 100 nanoseconds to about a microsecond. So they're on a time scale that can be simulated. Hairpins are a little bit longer, depending on where one realizes this stabilization for hairpins of, say, 15 or 16 amino acids. If the stabilizing hydrophobic interactions are far down the strands, then one would calculate that these rates could be as slow as 100 microseconds. That's assuming the mechanism is correct. The mechanism may change. It could be that you'll get a hydrophobic collapse followed by zipping, and it'll be interesting to see whether there is this 100-fold range of rates for hairpins. Contacts, depending on the stiffness of the chain, we think are going to are going to vary for, say, a contact separated by 10 residues are going to vary about tenfold between 100 nanoseconds and a microsecond. And from these results, we actually made a a kind of semi-empirical argument that if it takes these times for these elements to fold, that a reasonable guesstimate for the maximum rate in which a protein could possibly fold, which we call the sort of Smoluchowski speed limit, as an analog of Smoluchowski's upper limit for rate of a bimolecular reaction in solution, we're guessing about 10 to the 6th per second. Now, you can see in this plot that these measured rates have not gotten faster than about 100 microseconds. So there's really looks like we're pretty safe, that we still have two orders of magnitude to go. And recently, Ugo Meyer and Chris Johnson and Alan Furst, their supervisor in Cambridge, started looking at a protein called N-grailed homeodomain. And published a paper a couple of months ago in PNAS pointing out that this protein is folding in of the order of 10 microseconds. So it's now by far the fastest folding protein that's been directly measured. There are claims of proteins that will fold this fast, but it's all done by extrapolation. I guess the most intriguing possibility from a theoretical point of view would be that that it's a downhill folder. That the barrier is the effective free energy barrier separating the denatured and the native state has disappeared, and this is just a diffusive motion with down a free energy gradient. And of course, this would be probably not going to work out. But if true, it would be the fabulous molecule to look at by single molecule spectroscopy. Because if you have a two-state system, all you see is unfolded and folded, and you don't see anything in between. If you have a system which does not have a barrier, then all the intermediate structures are observable. So our idea would be then, of course, we would have to slow this down dynamically, but we could do that with viscosity. So if we could get a system where we could, which was a downhill folder, and we could maintain its downhill folding properties, then we could look at it by single molecule spectroscopy, which has poor time resolution because it takes time to collect enough photons to get something that's statistically significant. And so we've been working on trying to, pardon me? We're collecting, as you'll see, I'll show you what we're collecting in a second.
I think if you have always a barrier to make the first turn, because of that,
Yeah, so...
It can't be downhill.
No, it can't be downhill for every little microscopic step, but the helix is going to be something that is in the helix. These are unstable helices, so they're going to be in constant equilibrium with respect to the overall folding process. And that's why the overall process looks like it's downhill, because all of these things are constant equilibrium. So this is an instrument, which I won't talk about in any detail, that Everett Lippmann has put together in my lab, who was trained in astrophysics at Berkeley. And the challenge for him was, as a graduate student, he was trying to detect one photon out of some gigantic number, like 10 to the 35th coming from some galaxy. And he was intrigued by the challenge of collecting 10% of the photons from an individual molecule. So he's worked to build what I think is, you'll see in a second, I think is a state-of-the-art instrument. And this is just an this is an experiment where we put a dye, Alexa 488. This is its absorption spectrum. This is its green emission. And at the other end of a polypeptide, we put Psi-5. Here's its absorption, so there's overlap of this emission from the Alexa 488 and the absorption of the Psi-5. That means that you can get excitation energy transfer according to Forster theory. And now the question is, how much of this excitation energy is is transferred from the Alexa 488 to the Psi-5. So if there's excitation at 488, there's almost no absorption of this dye. So almost all of the excitation goes in to the donor dye, so-called donor dye. And from the ratio of the a number of photons that are coming out of this guy and coming out of that guy, you can say something in the ideal experiment about the distance between these two chromophores. So you can imagine putting these two chromophores on a polypeptide, initiating folding, watching the polypeptide creep along because of the dynamics slowing it down towards the native state, and watch the distance between two positions on the polypeptide change as a function of time. And this just shows that he has a state-of-the-art signal-to-noise. These are the counts per millisecond in, this is times. This is just looking at molecules diffuse into the focal volume. And here's the green channel. This is detecting the donor photons. This is detecting acceptor photons. You see the noise is extremely low. Right, the mean value here is like 3. He's collecting data for a millisecond, so they're millisecond bins. So this is like 3 photons per millisecond, and this is like 1 photon on average per millisecond. And he's seeing single molecule spikes as the molecules come floating by. They sit there for about a millisecond, and you collect photons. Here he's collected 100 photons, so he's getting quite reasonable. Pardon me?
What is the origin of these spikes?
The spikes? There's continuous irradiation of the solution, right? And when a guy comes in, what you're doing is you're exciting the Alexa 488, and it's emitting a photon. These molecules have lifetimes of a few nanoseconds. And if you look at what's happening in both channels, for example, in this experiment, here's Alexa 488 at the end of polyproline, which is a rod, and here's Psi-5, right? So you're exciting Alexa 488. It's emitting green photons. So you separate these with a Dykroc filter. I didn't want to go through the details of the instrument, but so you have two detectors. One of them counts green photons. One of them counts red photons. Okay. And when there's equal counts in both channels, you get this purple bar. But here, he's just showing two events. Okay. So here, were 51 photons went into the green channel, And if you look down here, I mean, obviously most of it's noise, but then you see these obviously tremendously significant peaks, many, 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 many standard deviations from the mean. You see 50 counts. We picked this one accidentally because we chose the photophysical properties of these two dyes to be such that there would be 50% energy transfer. And if you do an ensemble experiment on 10 to the 20th of these molecules, that's what you see. You see about 50% transfer. So this is obviously selected because there's going to be a distribution. And here's another event in which, so there's this 51 photons and 50 photons. That's this event. So this this molecule diffused into the beam, and it was continuously excited, right? And sometimes it transferred, half the time, it transferred its excitation energy to this guy, which emitted a red photon. Now, in this case, you see, since we have a rod, we know what the distance is. And if the motion of these dyes is exploring all possible solid angles in the lifetime of the dye, which we think is going on, then you would see the average value. And that's why you see something close to 50%. And here's another event where he counted 15 photons. Now in the red channel, that's higher. There's more in the red channel, 13 photons in the green channel. All right?
If almost not full, just extended, there are no transfer. What should you see? If you have a mold that's fully extended and walk into the beam, should you just see the greens?
No, because the overlap integral here is about 50 angstroms.
Okay.
So that's the so-called R0. So when you actually calculate out the Forster integrals, what's the probability of transfer? It's 50% for this molecule going this distance from here to there, sort of roughly, because the reason we're actually looking at this molecule as a way of getting started in this business is we want to explore the angular dependence with a fixed distance. So you can imagine we can do MD simulations of this. We can change the viscosity, so we can here the reorientational correlation time for these things is of the order of hundreds of picoseconds. So that's fast. That's shorter than the lifetime. Then we can go to the high viscosity regime where these guys are fixed. So now it depends on the angular relations, right? And the goal, as I said, is you attach this to a protein and get a protein to creep to its native structure and watch these distances as a function of time. But I think that's a long way off. I mean, there's just a lot of technical problems that I can tell you about afterwards. So these are the lists of co-workers in the Laboratory of Chemical Physics that have worked on these problems. Lisa Lapidus, who came from low-temperature plasma physics, I guess she's done the work on the tertiary contact formation. Guri Joss has done the work on the viscosity dependence of the helix coil transition and the beta hairpin kinetics. Victor Munoz, who's this very talented postdoc who did all of the beta hairpin work. Steve Hagen studied polypeptide collapse, which I didn't talk about, and we've also collaborated with Lois Pollack at Cornell and Bob Austin doing time-resolved low-angle X-ray scattering with the synchrotron at Cornell to look at the radius of gyration as a function of time to actually monitor the collapse. The experiments I told you about on Alan Firsch's N-grilled homeodomain were carried out by Guri Joss, essentially, repeating the experiments with just somewhat better time resolution that were done by Chris Johnson and Ugo Mayer in Cambridge. I've already mentioned Everett Lippmann, who's physics, who came from astrophysics. Ogitsa Bakayan is now involved in the single molecule work, and the protein that we're putting these labels on is being prepared by a biophysical chemist, Ben Schuler, and all of the experimental work that I talked about has been carried out in collaboration with senior colleague at the NIH, Jim Hofrichter, and Eric Henry, and Attila Sabo is our resident theorist who's played a major role in keeping our heads on straight and guiding us in the right direction. So, thank you for your attention.